Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. And it's been a while, hasn't it? It's been quite a while since I've talked to you guys. Several months, probably approaching 3 months now. A quarter of a year has gone by. And here I am, jumping back on, doing my best with my guest today, who is Adam Levin, a sweetheart of the Northeast guitar scene. He came out with an album of music from Israel last year that I talked about, and now he's already coming out with a new album. We're going to talk about that. He was nice enough to call and just he wanted to kind of pay for an ad spot, and I had had him on with his trio like years ago, and I hadn't just had him, and I think he's enough of a powerhouse to where I thought, you know, I'd really like to just sort of talk to this guy for an hour. And we get along, you know, we've always had a sort of a pretty good relationship. So I wanted to explore our friendship in a deeper way. And we're going to do that. The show is sponsored by SavageClassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E Classical.com. You can always go there and get the guitar of your dream. Just tell them Big Diaper Brett sent you. That's SavageClassical.com. RosettaPodcast.com/insider. RosettaPodcast.com/insider is where you can go to get a subscription for as little as $8 a month. $8 a month, or you can pay $200 and you can just have it for the rest of your life. Until you die, you'll be learning languages at RosettaPodcast.com/insider. Don't go to RosettaStone.com, right? Don't be a basic B and do that. Don't go to RosettaStone.com, because I don't see any money. You got to go to RosettaPodcast.com/insider. I can't remember. Did I stop advertising for them? I can't remember. I think I did. Am I right? Is this an old read? I don't remember what happened with them. All right, then whatever. You get that one for free. Well, you get it for free anyway, unless you guys go to RosettaPodcast.com/insider. Make sure you go to Richard Savage, though. Richard Sage at SavageClassical.com. Also, today in the intro, special day, right? We've got Mark Grigich is going to be on to talk about his Bach album, which came out, The Well-Tempered Guitar, Mark Bach. And he is just going to talk about his album for a quick minute in a little bit. But first, let's just see what's going on. What are we doing here? I got Toni Morris coming on at some point. That's a messy one. I got to go back and fix that. I feel like every time I talk to you guys, I'm talking about how I got this Toni Morris interview that's sitting in the wings. But I didn't want to come back with an old interview. I wanted to come back with a new interview. So I'm going to talk to Adam, and that's the way we're going to get things rolling. So I was in a bubble. I was unable to leave. I was unable to go eat out, go take some time to myself outside of camp. They put me in a bubble, and we just stayed there. And I am not doing that again. It was kind of okay for me. I had my own space, but for the counselors, it just seemed like hell on earth. I mean, these poor guys were stuck with kids 24/7 for 9 weeks. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, talk bad about camp. The camp must go on, I understand, but whoa, boy, I mean, there wasn't any time for them to just get off and go screw around. It was insane looking at what those counselors went through. I hope they're okay. Some of them aren't, but, you know, it's still fun. Played a lot of board games, watched a lot of Mets. They had SNY up there on the old television. That's good, because I'm not going to pay $100 to watch Mets, especially the way they're doing. Boy, that's a disaster. Is anybody following that? I mean, they were in first place for the entire season, and then the last month and a half, they haven't won a game. It's the saddest thing, you know, all dependent on DeGrom. Welcome to baseball podcast hosted by a guy who knows nothing about baseball except for the personnel on one baseball team. So I was able to do that. Didn't get too much guitar done, but got a lot more knowledge in the recording department. You know, I got better at that, got faster at it, got faster at mastering, got faster, you know, running this stuff, because you got all these little bands coming in and, you're just burning through them, like setting them up, recording drums. I didn't know how to record drums before, you know, I started doing this. So that's pretty neat. and just getting better, sort of coloring things, losing plugins, all that fun stuff. When you're recording rock and roll, setting up live performances, getting better with that, getting better with live sound, figuring all that stuff out, speak on cables. You guys know what those are? No, you don't. You're a classical guitarist. You have no idea. so I, you know, I dealt with all that stuff. And I led it to success. So I feel happy about that. Real creative with the afternoons. I set up something called Rock Shop Coffee Shop. That's what it's called. It's called Rock Shop. You set up a coffee shop and the kids get to spend this money. There's this currency that I invented. It's a Rock Shop currency. I didn't invent the name. One of my counselors, Levi, invented the name and he named it Johnny Cash. And the kids would earn Johnny Cash by like learning how to play drums or learning how to play guitar. And then, all right, we had this stuff printed out. We spent like $180 having like these really high quality, printouts of the money. And the kids would earn the money by playing drums. And then they would spend the money at the Rock Shop coffee shop in the afternoon, which I transformed the recording studio into a little French bistro. There's like a menu. And I was the host. So I was Viscount de Pabray, and I would host, and there was like a Argentinian tennis instructor who also played music. So he came in. There was a poet called Amor who came in and did like poetry. She's a student right now, and she was an amazing poet. Like, just you'd think the kids wouldn't want to listen to poetry on a hot afternoon in a recording studio at the top of a hill, but they were all about it. And they were all about it also because I gave them candy. I gave them so much candy, about 30 minutes before dinner, and they were happier. They were like 30 of them would line up. It was the most exclusive club on camp, baby, and it's great, just a variety show. So that's something to be proud of, and that's an idea for you. Currency, all right? You create currency, and then you give it to kids. They collect it. It's like Pokemon. It's like baseball cards. They're just like, they can't get enough of it. They want to get it because it's pretty. I'm telling you guys, we all should do this from now on. Don't steal Johnny Cash from me. That's mine, okay? All right, so we did that. That was the system. And these kids, they would play drums. What would normally take a kid like a lesson or two, learning like a basic beat, one on the kick, two on the snare, three on the kick, four on the snare, then the ands are all the hi-hat. These kids were doing it in 5 minutes because there was cash on the line. Playing G chords, C chords, and D7 chords on the first three strings. They would even get to that D7 chord. Never touched a guitar in their lives. Within 20 minutes, they're playing a three chord progression. Why? Johnny Cash. All right, I'm not above it. I'm not above paying my kids to get good grades. I'm not going to pay in cash. I'm just going to make up something fun. Think about it. That's fun. You got to remember what it was like to be a kid. You liked little stupid things. Remember that you'd be in line at the grocery store and my eyes were just fixed on that checkout line. It's like, Mom, can we get the toilet paper? And we'll stop for cereal. I'll spend some time there. I'll spend 20 minutes picking out cereal. But other than that, my eyes are set on that checkout line. I like the colorful, stupid things, and that's all you got to do. Give them a colorful, stupid object, and you can get them to do, you'll get them to play drums in 5 minutes. I had an entire band ready to record in 4 days because Johnny Cash was on the line. Very successful. And thanks again to old Levi, the old counselor, for making up the name to that. I mean, we were sitting there brainstorming the name for the money, and he had his hands, and he's sitting there, and he's just, I thought he was crying. And he looks up with a big grin on his face and goes, I think we should call it Johnny Cash. And I just said, that's the best thing I ever heard. Anyway, that's my story for today. Are you guys excited to be back with Classical Guitar Insider? I'm excited to be back. All right? So let's go ahead. I'm going to talk to Mac for a second about his new album, and then we'll get on with Adam. Hey, Mac.
Hey, Brett.
Well, thanks for coming on and sharing some information about your new album. It is a Bach album, and there's a lot of Bach albums that, you know, everybody kind of releases their Bach album. This is yours, but there's more to it than that. There's sort of a concept behind it, from what I understand. You're playing it on a very special guitar. You're playing it on, I think it's called True Temperament. Is that what it's called? Am I right about that?
There's certainly the word temperament in, but it's not true. It's
Well-tempered
guitar.
Well-tempered guitar is the name of the album, or no? It's just Mac and Bach.
It's the subtitle of the album. Mac Bach is the title, and then the well-tempered guitar is the concept of the tuning behind the whole repertoire.
And this is interesting because you have based this on historic alternate tunings, that trace all the way back to the time of Bach. That haven't necessarily been explored, at least to the degree of having an entire album represent this tuning. But you know, what's the story behind that? What got you interested in that, and how did you execute it on this album so beautifully?
So a while back, I met the microtonal music guru here in Los Angeles, John Schneider, and the whole concept of alternate tuning really appealed to me. The color that came out with a crunch between different notes and in within cadences, how that is processed. That was quite exciting to me. And then as I started to explore different tunings, historical tunings that were relevant, we stumbled upon the well-tempered tuning, which is nothing new. Obviously, the well-tempered clavier has been around for a while. So we said, okay, we have this guitar with movable frets. Why don't we try to do something with it? We used the guitar. We calculated the pitches. We used a well-tempered proposed tuning by Johann Sebastian's student, Mr. Kirnberger, and came up with the concept of well-tempered guitar. And it's been quite exciting. The colors, the intenseness of the harmonies, everything that unfolds in the music that we're so used to listening to in equal temperament becomes so much richer, right?
Wow.
And yeah. That is something that really appeals to me, and I think to the listeners as well. It's not drastic. It's just slight, but it's just enough to make a difference.
For information about this album and more, make sure to visit makgrigic.com. That's makgrigic.com. There's a wonderful video of him performing one of the pieces featured on the album. He's performing it on the guitar that we were just speaking about. So make sure that you visit makgrigic.com. And now we move on to our featured guest, Mr. Adam Levin. Adam Levin has a new album of his own out. It is the fourth volume of 21st century Spanish guitar music. And it is currently Billboard's number one traditional classical album, and has been for the last week. So it's a big deal. Very proud to have him on. Here's my time with Adam Levin. So the thing is that we are re-recording this. You and I had a magnificent conversation about your album.
It was perhaps the greatest conversation I've ever had in my life. And it's as if that chunk of time, that hour, just never happened.
I mean, yeah. I didn't look at the thing that says recording and make sure it was on. I have to just admit that I'm a little bit, it's either I'm getting old or I'm kind of new to this format.
There's too many buttons we're responsible for these days. And honestly, if you call the NSA, it's probably recorded on their channels.
Yeah, so. I should just call up the administration, the current administration. Let's do our best. I think that we had a couple of gems there. We talked about how you're from Chicago and how you think that deep dish pizza is the best food in the world, and how I agree with you, but I also think it's going to kill us. I think it's the most unhealthy food in the world. I don't think anybody should eat it, but I agree that it's probably the
most
delicious.
And it's the only kind of food that is digested by our hearts.
Right, that our hearts get fat. We had a whole bit, and it doesn't sound the same the second time through.
That's okay.
just like pizza. So go ahead.
Oh, nothing. I just, no one can live a full life or fully realized life without a deep dish pizza.
Now, you were talking about your dad. We actually are going to, maybe we'll go in reverse and we'll see how that works.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
You know, so your dad starts out, he's a guitar guy, right? So he's got all
these
guitars.
His name is Man Batman. You might know him.
Batman?
Dad. He's my superhero.
My dad is my superhero. That can't be. Is that true? Is your dad funny? You're a funny guy. Is your dad funny?
He's a dry humored fellow. You know, it's funny. My grandparents were these socialites, his parents.
Like socialites, and, like rich socialite? New
no,
Yorkers?
Socialites, like they were social. Very, like they oh. they went out, they enjoyed friends and family.
Not
and,
like the Hilton family. That's
no,
not what we're talking
about. No, okay. Yeah, there's no money legacy to be spoken of.
That's okay.
That's right. We any dynasty that we built it's built from within.
So your dad is a like you're saying a self-made
clinical psychologist and an amateur classical guitarist.
How is that? How's that being raised by a psychologist?
Great. Yeah, it was great when he hooked me up to the electrical chair, and the shock therapy was fantastic.
I imagine it's like a teacher having a parent that's a teacher. That's like a leg up in like being a parent, and being a psychologist must be a leg up in like just kind of going like, I'm not going to overreact to things. You know, I'm not my emotions. I'm going to count to 10. He must have,
you know, everybody, I think people, they've asked me this before, and I think, you know, he was a psychologist at work and he was a father at home. He was just a great dad. You know, he just did his thing at home, and he did his thing at work, and you know, separation of church and state, and same thing with my mom. I mean, she was a basically a stockbroker. She was an options trader, and you know, she was a hardened workaholic. She entered that field when there were approximately zero other women in the field. And she is the strongest woman I've ever met in my life. And she just bulldozed through any of those men that were in her way. And she made her way to the top, which imprinted really well on me. Is, you know, it's like you got to persevere amidst obstacles and challenges and so forth. No matter what, you persevere. Mm-hmm. You conquer.
Yeah, stockbroker so that's what they had to do in like 1990. You know?
Yeah. So it was very interesting. It was a household in which work and education were a primary focus. And that came, I guess you could say, before fun. And it was always a focus. I remember, you know, it's like we didn't go out, my sister and I, until we practiced or we did our homework. You know, that fun was afterwards. And I remember my dad, he would get my sister and I, who was also a classical guitarist, but I guess once you're a classical, always a classical guitarist. But during the early days, he would get us up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and he would say, like, listen, you know, you guys have homework, so you have extracurricular activities, sports, friends, all the crap and craziness that comes with being a kid. And the best time was in the morning. And yeah, did we ever fight with him about that. But it was a really interesting time to grow up as a musician in the morning. It's when you're freshest. It's when you learn the fastest. It's when you sort of, you're the most sponge-like. Everything you learn is, you're incredibly impressionable in those early hours of the day. So it was really unique.
What about your sister? Your sister was a guitarist. I think we talked about it. She's not a guitarist anymore.
Yeah, she's not a classical guitarist anymore, but she was fantastic. I mean, she was extraordinarily accomplished. And, you know, she came up with the same training I did. She then went on, she went to Yale, studied with Ben Verdery for a little bit, but just decided it wasn't her thing and went on to become a physician. She's a dermatologist in Boston, which is awesome because we're both in Boston, so we get to see each other often, and we actually lived together for 7 years and really have a fantastic bond. And until I met my wife, we were
roommates
in the same house. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wow. Roommates. I didn't know that's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy. Great. Living with a sibling was great then, right?
Oh, it's unbeatable. It's the best. I recommend it to anybody.
I think the ship has sailed. Both my brothers are married. Unless something goes south with Melissa or Molly, then they have to come over here. But so, you know, that's, so did you ever play with your sister then?
Oh yeah. We had duos. We had trios with my dad.
My brothers want to play music with me, but they're nowhere near. I mean, they can't do it. I would love to have, like, no offense to them, they're great. I'd love to have a brother that played classical music that I could play with, that I could, you know, put something down and read with, you know.
Do you make him feel bad about it?
Yeah, I mean, I do sometimes, because I think he was like, let's jam. And so we jam, you know, you jam like you jam with a regular guy for 5 seconds.
Totally.
Or like 5 minutes, and you're like, all right, well, do you have any ideas? They're like, no. And then I'm like, well, I don't do this. So,
yeah, it was nice. It's something that really bound our family together. Yeah. I mean, we went to Boston. We went to Chicago Classical Guitar Society concerts together. We practiced at the same time in the morning. We were playing similar repertoire. I mean, she was. It was a really unifying feature of our family, and still is to this day. I mean, when I talk to my dad, we talk shop about the guitar. Vintage guitars, whatever. He can talk about guitars all day long. That's like what he loves to the core. And, you know, my dad, he brought me up with guitar icons like Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix, you know, jazz greats, Wes Montgomery, Joe Pass, you know. So there was the best music being listened to growing up. And, it was funny, you know, instead of putting an electric guitar in my hand or a jazz guitar, he put a classical guitar in my hand because he thought that it was literally the bridge to any style that I wanted to play in. And to some extent, it is, but I just loved classical guitar. And, you know, the experience of learning classical guitar for my sister and I was very different. For me, I just didn't know there was any other option. It was like, oh, here's a guitar. It's got nylon strings. Like, guess is this the style for me. For my sister, she's like, wait a second.
There's this whole rock thing I kind of like.
Yeah, I mean, she was just more of somebody to call into question the regimen, the teaching style, my parenting style, what she wanted to do. I mean, she, you know, by the time she got to college, she became like sort of a world-class sailor and was doing all these regattas, and I have no idea. Have you ever been to a regatta? It's gibberish. I've never been able to make sense of it.
What's a regatta? Is that like a boat thing? Is that like a
sand? It sounds like a dance, honestly, but it's like a boating dance, basically. And it's some sort of, I honestly can't tell you. I have no idea. And I haven't, to be honest, been in a boat with my sister.
Is this like row? Because I know rows.
No, that's rowing. This is like sailing. And she's really light, so you want someone light in the front and someone heavier in the back. So she was like everybody's first choice to be a sailing partner.
Oh my god! So yeah, that's the kind of person.
Yeah, honestly, my mind kind of melts even thinking about it because I don't understand it, which is fine. But yeah, it was very different experiences for her and the guitar and me and the guitar, which is, you know, I think when it comes to parenting, it's something I'm thinking of now that I have my own little one, I have another one, is, you know, one baby or one child is going to learn and enjoy very different things than a second child or baby. You know what I mean?
You have a four, what people should know is that you have a 4-month-old child that you just had your first baby.
Yeah,
it's in the other room.
Wild, yeah.
Is it napping now? What's going on with it now?
No, he's flying around the room like a bat.
Oh, okay. So we'll hear him again. We'll get another. We'll get a little more.
Yeah, he's. It's been one of the most erratic. Yeah, there he is. Oh my god.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a little cameo where he'll take over the interview.
100%. I mean, we might as well.
Yeah, I am worthless compared to him.
You are doing the best job possible.
It's been an amazing adventure, and I think being a musician honestly prepared me perfectly for being a father, because the life of a musician, it can be erratic, it can be spontaneous, you don't know what to expect, you sort of do things on the fly, you adapt. That's like fatherhood, parenthood 101. You don't know what kind of ball the pitcher is going to give you. So there's curveballs happening every moment. So it's, but it's been beautiful. And you know, we were talking about this in podcast version one.
I didn't press record. That's what happened. I don't know if I got that out there, but I did not press record.
These damn buttons.
I have one job. It's to press record. That's like my one physical thing that I need to do other than just to talk nonsense and listen is press the button. All right. So I didn't do that. And you were talking about it in version one.
Yeah, what were we talking about in version one?
Well, you were talking, talking about the kid and how, you know, the kid sort of, you think it's going to throw you off course, but it actually just, no, I think you were saying it makes you kind of sharper. It makes you kind of razor sharp and efficient.
Yeah.
And aerodynamic was a word that you had
used. I think I've gone.
Because I was afraid. I think this all comes from me. I'm in a point now where, you know, I'm in this relationship. It's been about a year. She's 34. We're thinking about it. You know what I mean? We're having the conversation of like, you know, she really wants one, and I'm just going like, well, yeah. Why the hell not? Who cares?
You'll be the best version of yourself. That's what I can tell you. It's a blast.
You feel that way. You feel better.
Oh, totally. And it brings out your like inner child, and you just there is no bound to yourself when you have a little one next to you. It's the ultimate. It's also the ultimate expression of love. I mean, I always thought that playing music and loving my wife was that, but a baby is next level. It's really deep. It reaches a new core.
That's the thing is I think new is what I've kind of haven't experienced in a long time. Yeah. If I do experience it, it's like, you know, I don't know if there's a food that's like, just like I've gone like, oh, I've never tried that or an experience or a concert or, you know, it's things are so repetitive by the time I'm in my 40s, and I'm just like, whoa, maybe there's something else. And I think
this will keep you on your toes for the rest of your life.
There you go. The rest of my life for sure.
Yeah. and also I selfishly want a friend for Avi. So, get on.
Well, you want a Brett child.
Exactly.
So I'm going to call him Oat. So you want Oat and Avi to play together.
Exactly.
I'd have to have that baby fast. Otherwise your baby's going to sit there and tease my baby and it's going to make fun of it. And it's going to bully it. It's going to have a Boston accent and it's going to be like you Yankee piece, you know, and I'll be like, look, he's not a Yankee. We're Mets. I'm going to the Mets game tonight, actually.
Oh, nice.
But your kid will bully my kid. So I got to get on that.
What we're going to do is we'll put both of them in karate classes immediately so that they can take on the world when they try to bother them.
Yeah, back to back. Just to back, arms up.
I mean, I loved, actually, that. Speaking of martial arts and karate, I loved karate. I did it for like 15 years growing up, and it was a transformational experience for me. I mean, I was not really like a team sport kind of guy. It wasn't like not really coordinated enough for football, or I didn't, you know, have the killer crossover in basketball. I had a really good 3-point shot, but karate really helped me focus and like refine like who I am, which I still am trying to answer today. I think we're in sort of like a unending identity crisis. Like, who are we as classical guitars? Who am I as a classical guitarist? What do we want to be? When we grow up, and karate really helped answer a lot of those like questions early on, and it was very centering. If I didn't need my hands for a living, I would totally be back at karate. It was fantastic, and I had I've had really good mentors all along throughout my life, from my dad to my first guitar teacher, Shinobu Sato, a great Japanese-American guitar instructor, to Ann Waller, Mark Maxwell, to Elliot Fisk. I studied with him for almost 8 years. He's still guiding me. Oscar Gilia. I mean, it's in the famous Siena classes. I mean, those are, you can't go a lifetime without being in Siena. And then when I was in Spain, I was with Gabriel Estherez. So there's like all these like major figures in my life who sort of helped usher me into the next stage of my musical development. And, you know, it's not every day when you have really good imprinting throughout your life. I mean, there's There's bound to be somebody who's a kind of a plinker, but all of them were fantastic.
And as far as the karate is concerned, the karate really, it's sort of a similar approach. You know, you're practicing motions. There's a form to it. There's a technique. And like you said, is it a sport? I don't know. Yeah, sure. But it's like the main thing about it is that you are able to listen and we employ sort of the same things in just our daily practice, you know, the way.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, there's a physical, technical choreography approach to karate. And then there's this whole psychology behind it. And it's the same thing in music.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a spirituality you can choose to either engage with regularly or engage with at your leisure. There's a way with music to sort of be dispassionate about it, which you have to be if you're going to be doing it every day. I think sometimes you just have to get up and do it, whether you feel like doing it or not.
Can't always totally.
And you know, karate's got to be the same thing.
Discipline. Discipline. You got to maintain your art.
Right. Yeah. Rain or shine. As far as like that, you know, like you were talking a little bit earlier about identity crisis and stuff like that. Well, when I first met you, it was with a trio, which I guess was called I've already forgotten the name of it, but it's something about Necks. Great Neck.
Yeah, Great Necks. Yeah, it was the earlier iteration was the Cathar Project guitar trio, which we later changed into the Great Necks. And it is solely referring to the neck of guitar.
Of a human being. I'm sorry. Yeah, of guitar. And as far as like that, its relationship to Cathar, you were saying that you sort of, well, first of all, Cathar Project, that's kind of how I met you three guys. You had just started it. We're talking about 6 years ago at this point when I interviewed you last. I'm having you on as a soloist because you've just continued to grow. Like at that point, that's what you were doing. That's all you were really doing was that project. I mean, now since you have had sort of a plethora of albums come out, a lot of different projects, a lot of exciting ones. This year alone, you've released two albums, one of traditional Israeli music with a mandolinist and another one of modern music written by people that are at least associated or live in Spain. So modern Spanish, you know, original compositions. For the guitar. So you've been doing all this stuff. But when I first met you, I would like to talk about the Cathar Project a little bit and sort of how that came about, because that's, you know, something that, you know, as guitarists in our community, we're all kind of aware of it. You guys have opened up satellites in Mexico City and in Albuquerque. How did you and Matt and Scott sort of meet and come up with this concept? And so what sort of drove you to do something philanthropic?
Insanity.
I mean, it's a lot. Yeah. It is a kind of insanity.
It's a lot, but I think the heartbeat is really our love and passion for the guitar. And, you know, of course, any guitarist will probably say that they love the guitar more than anything and are really passionate about it, and that's fantastic. And I think what brought us together was our joint vision for sharing the guitar in a sort of community-based guitar education format, in a way that was accessible, that allowed us to express ourselves, to share our love with this instrument, and to do it in a sustainable way. I think we were grappling, and I think this to some extent was why we separate ourselves from the Cathar Project guitar trio and went towards the Great Necks, is that the sort of short-term sort of teaser-esque performances that we were sort of considering when we were considering models of how to educate the community, we could have either gone the teaser route, which is like you go across the country and the world and you provide shows and show everybody the magic of the guitar and then you're on your way. Or conversely, you establish long-term programming that will be part of the fabric of the community. And we were told by other nonprofit organizations, mentors, that the route to go was sustainable and to really imprint on these communities, to transform them. And the only way to have that possibility was to be there year after year. And so
as an instructor,
As an instructor,
right,
yes.
Right, right.
And giving these communities all of the basic guitar education amenities that we call like a first-class music education, which right. are group classes, individual classes, the guitars, the instructors, taking them on field trips to Guitar Society concerts, bringing guest artists to inspire the kids in the classroom, doing intense residencies, connecting our four programs, which are in Boston, Albuquerque, and Mexico, to one another, using Cathar Project as a platform for cultural exchange, understanding people that are different than yourself but are in pursuit of the same thing. It's like, you know, I remember when I was a kid, you know, one of the problems, at least when I was growing up, was that it felt so insular. It was a solo project. I was practicing by myself. There was no measure for my success, really. So I think that bringing young people together and making music together is really great because it allows you to do something together. And I think we are always better together. We're a summation of all of our efforts, which is very much, which was and still is the case in Cathar Project. Our joint efforts combined make all this possible.
Yeah, and right now it's you and Matt running it. And
that's correct.
You have sort of the Mexico City. You said there's some sort of ribbon cutting or something going on. What's happening?
So over the last 4 years, we have been fundraising. Because
I know Matt lives down there now. He's, you know.
Yeah.
Doing the pottery and everything. We talked about the he's also an amazing potter. He's just an amazing person at anything he does. I don't want to play cards with him or anything.
Yeah. If you give him cards today, he'll beat you tomorrow.
And then he'll do magic tricks in front of us. Then
exactly. Like... Yeah. Yeah. He'll be wearing like a Baroque wig and stealing all your money.
That's right.
Matt decided 4 years ago to move down to Mexico City from New York. And dedicated his life to Cathar Project and ceramics, and he's also he's a virtuoso at everything he does. It's something I've come to really respect about him is everything is all in, you know. Yeah. He's a very dedicated and loyal musician and artist. I really respect that a lot. Yeah. And then we've been able to build a wonderful team of instructors and administrators. And we're building this out. It's the very positive and heartwarming version of Fight Club. It's like instead of fighting, we're making music. But we have these little ecosystems that we're building of music making, guitar education, and all around the world. You know, it's really cool.
It is cool, and I mean, you know, so you move on from that. You guys do the trio. I mean. An album came out with a trio just like, I would say like 2 years ago or 3 years ago. Not that long ago.
I'm actually going to press rewind for just a second. I forgot to mention. So you asked about Mexico and
Mexico, the ribbon cutting. Yeah. Press rewind.
How could I forget? So
don't press anything. Don't press anything.
Yeah, exactly. Here we are right where we were supposed to be. So we're building a music school in Mexico City and we've been fundraising for it for the majority of the last 4 years. And it's going up. We will have a brick and mortar music school designed by one of the coolest and hippest Mexican architects. By January, by December or January, this will be done.
Tell me about the architect. Now, how did the architect get involved? How did you get like a hip architect to build this?
Matt.
This is crazy.
Yeah, it actually is kind of an insane thing that we were able to get this done. Yeah. So Matt's father is a prominent architect in Albuquerque.
Okay.
He was being awarded some prestigious award in, I think it was Florida, in Orlando. And at that dinner table, he was sitting next to perhaps the most famous modern Mexican architect, Tatiana Bilbao. And he got to talking about Cathar Project and his son Matt's NGO, Cathar Project, and she was super excited about it. So fast forward, Tatiana was psyched about it, and her protege, this guy Chipe, jumped on board, and he and his business partner designed this incredible building. And the building, the skin of the building, the walls of the building are made from donated bricks from the community or from the rubble from beneath, which is sort of rubble from the 1982 earthquake in Mexico City. And just to give you a little backstory on the community we serve, it's called Yugalito, and it's built, it's 1,000 families who built a community atop a former landfill. It's pretty striking, actually. The poverty is striking. They did not have running water. It was not officially recognized by the government, and slowly they are integrating themselves into the fabric of the larger Mexico City government and community. And so they have their own security. They have their own social and healthcare amenities, and it's quite incredible what they're doing down there. And in 2012 or 2013, they conducted a sociology study, and they surveyed the people who lived in the community, asking them what amenities they like to see in the future, and above and beyond anything else, they wanted music. So Matt, when he was down there for an embassy-sponsored performance and residency, heard about this, told us about this, me and Scott, and we had to answer that calling. It was simple as that.
That's incredible. We, talking just about how important it is to have a willing community. The community that's in a place that values that, rather than just sort of throwing, things at a wall. Sometimes I worked in the Bronx. We were talking about like how difficult that was for me to break in there, just because in that setting, I didn't see it working. I didn't see my skill set being going on in that setting. There was just so many things going on, and I know that all kids need and deserve music, but I felt bad about it. And I've always looked for a place. I'm always on the lookout for a place that, where I can help sort of an underserved community, and in a way that's sincere and in a way that's an effort between both of us.
It's definitely a conversation that you have to have.
With the community.
We had that with the community. It's like, would this be useful? Is this something that your community values or will value in the future? And it's been symbiotic since the beginning. The community loved us. We loved them. And we knew that this was a relationship that was going to grow. And I think, right now we're using a multi-use space. Soon we'll have our own home. And I think it'll symbolize our dedication to guitar education for as long as the building stands and for as long as the community exists, which is forever, hopefully. And it's really going to serve as a sanctuary, as a refuge, as a safe zone for these kids who sometimes the other options, the alternatives are far worse.
Yeah.
And so the guitar is really a means to express themselves, and it's a means of escape from some of the rough realities that surround them. And Matt's doing a tremendous job down there, and I'm helping lead the programming in Boston, and then we have a fabulous teacher in Albuquerque, Genevieve Leitner, who has spearheaded our programming there for the last 4 years, and is. Basically what we need is just we had more people sign up than we could possibly take. I mean, it was astounding. It's been a beautiful process. I don't think any of us thought that we would be in this position of running a nonprofit dedicated to music education and building this kind of infrastructure. It's tough. It's a lot of trench work.
Yeah.
It's not for the faint of heart. But, I was telling you this earlier, just as I look into my son Avi's eyes as he, keeps me up in the middle of the night, and I just sort of bow down to him and say, you are worth every moment, every second of my energy. It's the same thing with these kids in these communities. I see them play, I see them practice, they've got my heartstrings, and I'm like, I will work endlessly to ensure that this guitar and these teachers continue to educate you. It's really a powerful feeling, and it's become a compulsion,
right?
That I need to do this. It's not because it's not because I should. It's because I really want to. It's something that's absolutely necessary. It was like, I remember I had a moment in graduate school where, you know, there was this, like, it was the outreach. That was one thing. And then there was my performance career. And they were sort of two separate bubbles. But what I realized, and that served me really well, is that they are no different. They are one.
Yeah.
I will be better performer on the stage when I can better serve the community and bring them together, and vice versa.
You do have this other side to you, which is this active performer who is, I don't know if you're commissioning works, but right now you're doing really innovative recordings from the standpoint of repertoire. And let's just talk about your latest one, 20th century Spanish music. All the pieces have a, you know, quote, modern disposition. There's atonality going on. There's rhythmic syncopation. There's stuff that, you know, can be confusing to some people, but it all is grounded in the tradition of Spanish guitar music. It seems like it's very much aware of that, and it honors that. And so it makes music that would be otherwise very challenging to the audience, something that's more approachable and something that we can really get behind, whether it's through sort of traditional orchestration, which, you know, you can definitely hear that in the concerto, where, you know, the orchestration is very, it's very forward thinking, but it's also, it exhibits a great command of, you know, of the instruments that it's showcasing, and really, you know, not just a balanced approach, but innovative in that sense. So what was your experience going to Spain and sort of unearthing these composers?
I think before I get to Spain, I would like to mention that I think I have an equal compulsion towards performance, live performance, and getting before the public as I do sharing that in the, you know, in this guitar education forum that we call Guitar Project. I feel comfortable on stage. It's somewhere where I feel like I shine, and feel the most comfortable, and that's led to a lot of performances around the world. It's also led to a lot of recordings, of which I think the newest one's my 11th.
That's amazing.
And it's something that I enjoy. I love getting before the microphone and putting my imprint on, you know, whether it's a standard piece of standard repertoire or something fresh. And yeah, I mean, I think my entire life I was brought up to play this body of repertoire that had been passed down from maestro to student to maestro to student. And along the way, some of those maestros had commissioned new pieces and passed them along to the next generation. Segovia, Fisk, Gilia, Isben, Bream, all these great characters, and I think they all shared the desire to push the guitar to a new place beyond the frontier that we were comfortable with, and really push not only the guitar, the guitars themselves, but the audience. And in the same way, I went to Spain understanding Spanish music and Spain from a very simple and ignorant perspective, as if there was one Spain, one kind of music, one image of Spain. And going there, being there in person, looking up at the sky, at the sun, looking at the people, talking to the people, it broke down all those misconceptions and all that ignorance. I mean, there's multiple dialects being spoken in Spain, in Spain, from north, south, east, west. There's plenty of languages spoken in Spain, not just Castellano. In addition, each region, northeast with Barcelona, that's one very defined one. The Santiago de Compostela in the northwest, Andalusia, Castilla y León, all of them have a distinct topography, language, dialect. Valencia has Valenciano. Mallorca, one of the islands, Mallorquin. I mean, there's such diversity within the people, the language, the culture. It's astounding. And I think that has been reflected in the Spanish music of the past, and it's definitely been part of new music being created today. And I realized when I got there, I was fortunate enough to receive a Fulbright scholarship for not one, but 3 years. I was able to renew it, and then I got a couple other grants as well to help subsidize my addiction to Spanish culture. But it was high time to commission pieces like the people and big leaders of the past. And it was not enough to just play and recycle, you know, the music that...
Yeah, you were over there. Forever. You were in it. You had access, and you knew that, and you felt the impetus to do something more.
Totally. And then also just taught you, like, it's a unique opportunity to be able to speak and interact with composers. That's such an interesting process. It's a process that one should not go without.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you get to go like inside the brain of the creator and ask them all of the questions that we have to rely on secondary and tertiary sources for.
Yeah.
Bach, Scarlatti, all these, you know, it's like
we'll never know.
Yeah, we'll never really know. And with this music, you can cultivate a reference recording or performance based on knowledge from the composer.
So you met most of them. I mean, you know,
I met and courted. I mean, it was not easy to get some of them right for me. I mean, one of the probably the most well-regarded composers in the history of modern Spanish music, Cristóbal Halffter, which doesn't sound very Spanish, but he was indeed Spanish. It took me close to 10 years to get a piece from him. And, you know, the first time I called, I emailed him, and he said, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm writing a symphony or orchestra piece. Second time I wrote him, he's like, I'm writing an opera. And then finally, the third time I wrote him, he invited me to his castle. And I'm not joking. It was actually like a little mini Alhambra palace. And we broke bread. We drank wine. And then his wife forced him to write me a piece. Thank you. and it was amazing. I mean, it was he sent me the manuscript 4 months later. And it was, I remember, the scary part was that it was written in, Mont Blanc makes what kind of pens?
A fountain?
A fountain pen, exactly, yeah. Yeah, he was right, he wrote it all in fountain pen, and it was, the notes sometimes would drip. So I would sit there with a magnifying glass, and I literally wrote in every single note just to be 100% certain that I got the notes right. And it took me years to make him entrust me with his piece and then to get him right. And I was so embarrassed by the fact that I couldn't read his illegible handwriting.
Well, he wrote the whole thing with like old school, like...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What do you call that? Cursive or not cursive? What's it called?
It was just his pen.
Calligraphy.
Calligraphy. It was pen to paper. There was no such thing as finale to him. It was like he was right. And it was beautiful. I still have the manuscript photocopies in my archives, and it's just incredible. And he was such a powerhouse composer. He was such a kind individual, and so soft spoken. and so open. And yeah, it's definitely a piece. This is one of the pieces that will, I think, with all humility, be part of the standard repertoire. It's called Espacio de Guitarra. He's the Berio of Spain. He is absolutely the Berio of Spain. It's a profound work, visceral. So there's that. And then, yeah, and so I came back from Spain basically with a large body of works, and I was like, I need to find them a home. So yeah. I talked to Naxos and then Norbert Kraft, and they were delighted to do something like this. Nothing had ever been done like this.
Yeah, this is perfect for them. Yeah.
Yeah, so they did the first three volumes. And then I was like, you know, after doing the Naxos thing and the pandemic hit, and Norbert was like, I'm not seeing anybody until this is over. So I was like, oh, crap. So found a different label, Frameworks Records, which is fabulous, run by David Vislaki, who is a wonderful classical guitarist, electric guitarist, jazz guitarist, and a producer. He's really sort of a presidential figure in the guitar world and is trying to really industrialize the classical guitar recording world. And so we created some sort of record deal together, and this volume four is really the culmination of a lot of work and is the end of the conclusion of a more than 30 work commissioning project. It's got a concerto by one of my dearest and most coveted Cuban Spanish composers, Eduardo Morales Caso, and then there's a set of four Spanish commissions by Jorge Muñiz, who is the disciple or was the disciple of Leonardo Balada, who is also one of the head figures in Spanish composition of the last 100 years. And then I've got a piece by Joaquin Turina's grandson, Jose Luis Turina, which sounds nothing like Turina's works, but very special and unique and just a powerhouse piece. Really interesting. And I was telling this earlier, he lowers the sixth string to an E flat, which is really ominous. So you get like this very consonant sort of texture up above, and then you get this E flat below, which is really, it hits your,
you feel it.
Yeah, you feel it exactly. Yeah. And then you got this wonderful, actually it's the second piece I commissioned from Salvador Broton. It's called Sonata Sephardita, which taps into ancient Sephardic melodies and sort of a novel and fresh way. And it's been a delight. Honestly, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you're probably wondering, like, why is some American encroaching on Spanish territory like this? And there's no conquest in this. It was an opportunity that I saw. I arrived on the scene in 2008, and didn't see anybody doing it.
No one was doing it. Yeah, no. That's the thing.
It was just it was jackpot. And
yeah.
and there what I observed was a renaissance in Spanish composition, in which you have Spanish composers writing very cosmopolitan styles, so reaching worldwide. I mean, on this album, you've got
it's still though, every single piece sounds Spanish.
Yes, yeah.
Like it's got a thing in it. And what's cool is that each piece sort of draws different elements of Spanish music. So, you know, in the concerto, there's a lot of like sort of the harmonies sometimes will go in that direction. And in other pieces, well, you know, in the, who is it that's just directly quoting Albanez?
Oh, that's Leonardo Balada. Oh, no, no. That's, you mean Rodrigo.
The concerto Aranjuez. Yeah. Right. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Leonardo Balada, he's actually a composer that has sort of been a pillar of each disc and has contributed one piece to each volume. One pays homage to Albanez, like you said.
Right.
Another one to Enrique Granados. Another to Manuel de Falla. And finally, in this last volume, to Joaquin Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez.
And this is the last volume, so this is it. You're done with this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, I'm done with the project
with the catalog, as is. Yeah.
Yeah, with the catalog, you know, I'll continue to commission.
Continue to work with the guys, yeah.
Yeah, but I think this is, I've spent a large portion of my career so far with this. I've got other things that I'm aching to do, and I've contributed a lot, and I've given a stepping stone and perhaps inspired other young guitarists or my colleagues to do this something similar.
Yeah, go out there and find the people who are writing and ask them for the piece, you know?
What people have to understand is the future of the guitar relies on this kind of work. And I'm not saying, you know, applaud me or pat me on the back. I'm just saying this is like a principal part of being a musician. It's a responsibility.
Right.
Is to push the instrument further. And, you know, transcription is fantastic. And I'm surrounded by amazing transcriptions that my colleagues have done. Scott Borg, Matt.
But when 65 to 85% of the concert repertoire is transcriptions, which I think was occurring maybe, you know, when I got started, it was just, you'd get in there and.
Yeah,
most of everybody's recital was a transcription.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's only so many times we can hear the Ginastera Sonata, you know.
I feel that way. I mean, I feel that way. It's like, I'm not being offensive, but I'm done.
Exactly. Good night, Ginastera. Yeah. And the thing is, like, I love the piece. It's just that I think what I'm left with is what's next, and that was the question that got me started. It's like, man, we got this amazing basin of Spanish repertoire from Torina, Toroba, Albéniz, Granados. What the heck is next? How can we answer the successes that we've had in the past with something even better?
And look at you. You're looking for it.
Boom, boom, boom.
Bada boom. Not anymore, because now you have a baby, so you're probably just going to quit. I mean, really?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what I'm gonna do is, as soon as he can talks. Pick up the guitar, talks. As soon as he can like crawl, I'm gonna have him crawl on top of a guitar and start playing.
Or just break. I mean, it's. Do you think he could break your career, your baby?
No. No way. Yeah, there's no. Yeah, I do love him, but there's no way he's breaking my career. That's an interesting topic. I mean, that's I know children scare musicians because it's such a delicate career, but if you are dedicated enough and you are organized enough and you have the will, it should not. I mean. You know, Jason Vio, a lot of the great babies. Of course, it's just level two. It's just it's another iteration of yourself. I'm Adam Levin, classical guitarist with Baby Avi on my back, or playing guitar for me.
I'm very excited for this new part of your life, and I'll see you up there soon enough.
I want oat.
You want oat, baby oat. I don't know if I'll get away with that. I don't know if the lady will let me call my baby that I haven't decided I'm going to have oat. But you push me in a direction. I'm sure she'll be happy to hear that I talked to you and that I'm now going to have a baby.
Yeah, I double as a psychologist.
You, just like your father, you now have had three interviews with me. You are the first guest to have two. There was one guy, Victor Kalafidis, who came on the show, and I accidentally had him on twice. I didn't realize until halfway through the interview that I had already interviewed him. But that's what happened when you've been doing this for 10 years. It's like that. I guess I'm just going to lose it sometimes. And I lost
quirky
it again.
Things happen.
Dude,
quirky things happen.
This is the first time I haven't pressed the record button.
Yeah.
So that was weird.
I'm glad I ushered you into the world of not pressing buttons.
I don't know what it is. All summer I was pressing buttons, and I pressed all the right buttons, and now it's like I just have to get back into this and pay more attention and be better. But I think it was
what's
okay.
What's wrong with you, Brett?
I don't know. I don't know why I didn't press the record button. But you know, I had a really good time talking to you for the third time. It was really nice of you to come on.
I'll talk to you in 20 minutes for the fourth.
And with that, we're going to go ahead and we're going to stop talking to each other. We have now been talking to each other for about 3 hours. I'm so sorry, Ann. All right. I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. I appreciate it.
That does it for my time with Adam Levin. Make sure you visit adamlevinguitar.com to find out more about the new album, 21st Century Spanish Guitar Volume 4. It is currently, as of the release of this podcast, it has been there for a week. It is Billboard's number one traditional classical album. That is a terrific achievement for Adam, and it's a wonderful thing for the guitar. An honor to be friends with this guy. I'll see you guys next time. Bye.